CinemaJaw is sponsored by Overcast, an independent podcast app that embraces the open world of podcasting instead of locking it down. No exclusives, no premium content, no paywalls. Just a great podcast app for everyone. Get it for free in the App Store.
And we thank them for their support. Listening to CinemaJaw, the greatest movies podcast ever, recorded on location from our respective homes in Chicago. My name is Matt Kay, and with me is
Rye the Movie Guy. And this week on CinemaJaw, Matt, I am demanding of you to give me your top five list right now. And if not, I'm releasing those naked pictures that Phil took of you.
Oh, geez, man. That's more like a blackmail on society. Nobody wants to see that.
Going way back in the day when Phil was taking nude photos of Matt.
Oh, yeah.
Shots. I'm joking.
Jeez, poor Phil.
But we are covering our top five favorite blackmail films. Movies, themes, plot lines that have to deal with blackmail.
This was, and we'll get to this. This was tough. So I actually have a few blackmail scenes. I had to cheat a little bit. Surprisingly, such a popular crime, not so popular as a movie theme, I guess.
Tough to look up for sure, Matt, because I was researching, and I know there's more out there that you just got to come across. I don't think it's a topic that's been explored much. And when you're looking on the internet and trying to come up with ideas, I was going over films, looking over my DVD library, and I couldn't come up with that many blackmail films either. We'll see if we cross over, but I got my five.
Well, if you don't have a good top five, Ryan, what I actually did is take all the audio that we've recorded while the mics are on, but we're not like doing the show. You know what I mean? All the times you've said stupid and offensive things. And I've saved all of that over the years in a little file called Ryan. And if your list doesn't impress me, all I have to do is push a button and that goes right out onto GitHub for people to grab and listen to.
That is scary. Behind the scenes, what's funny about that, Jawheads, is me and Matt aren't the kind of people that are going to say anything like extremely offensive or,
No, we're pretty nice guys.
We are overall. So it's not that unbelievable. But obviously, we have conversations, especially when we're in the studio. Here we're at home. It's a little bit different. But when we're in the studio, we go in and we're getting ready to record. Usually, be it Phil or was it Elias or now Pat, they would hit the record button as we're getting ready just to test everything. And we'd be talking about all kinds of crazy stuff before the guests came in. And me and Matt have talked about, we don't like the idea that they're recording. Because like, man, we were just talking about something pretty weird and Phil's going to listen back to that when he's editing it. So
yeah, and save it somewhere. That's one of my greatest fears, that stuff is out there somewhere.
Oh, too funny. So the Jawheads are probably wondering, Matt, why are we doing blackmail films?
Well, it's because of our review this week, Ryan. We are covering the new Netflix film, Lovebirds, which does contain a bit of a blackmail element.
It does. It is a romantic comedy, but it does have blackmail involved. Also, Matt, it is the month of June. Wow. Sixth month of the year. It feels like the 12th month of the year since we've been inside for so long.
Oh boy, yes it does.
But that does mean we are turning a page and celebrating somebody new and looking back at the year. A quick recap here, Matt, for the Jawheads. January, we celebrated Robert Downey Jr. I should almost quiz Matt. I should almost quiz you. February, Anne Hathaway. March, we celebrated the studio Pixar.
Nice, yes.
April was Michael Shannon month, and May, which we just finished, the great Steve Carell was celebrated here on CinemaJaw.
I probably would have gotten all of those wrong.
I'm sure you would have. So we looked ahead. We looked at the film schedule. They're actually a bright spot. I'm going to be honest with you. I always am looking ahead at the movies coming out, and since we're trapped at home, we're looking at movies that are hitting the streamers. There's actually a good handful of films that I'm actually excited for coming out on Hulu, Netflix, Amazon Prime in the month of June. And one of those movies is Da Five Bloods. Five Bloods, directed by none other than Spike Lee. And with that, Jawheads, we announce June as Spike Lee month here on Cinemaja.
Spike Lee is one of my favorite directors. He's directed a few of my favorite movies of all time. So this is exciting to me, Ryan.
Well, let's start with a Spike Lee fact.
Okay. Spike Lee's first feature film was She's Gotta Have It in 1986, a film about a woman who envies the sexual freedom of men to have multiple lovers and decides to do the same thing by having three lovers at the same time. The film was shot in 2 weeks on a budget of $175,000. The film ultimately made more than $7 million at the box office. In 2017, Lee returned to his first feature film and converted it into a TV series. She's Gotta Have It became a Netflix series with the first season airing in 2017.
Wow, I have not seen that film. I have not seen the series on Netflix. I was unaware of the fact that Spike Lee movie had even been converted into a TV series. I did not know that.
I know. You'd think that would have had a little bit more hype around it, Ryan.
Looking it up, since I was the one that pulled that fact out, it did have two seasons. So it was semi-successful if it has two seasons on Netflix, I'd say.
Mm. Well, I got to say, Ryan, you did the right thing by choosing Spike Lee as our director.
So right before we started recording, I sent out a tweet on Twitter asking what people's favorite Spike Lee film is. Here's one right away mentioning Do the Right Thing as his favorite film. This one came from Movie Hot Take, at Movie Hot Take. Do the Right Thing. Just watched it again tonight. Brilliant, powerful, sad, angry, relevant. It's everything. I have not seen it. It's one that I've missed, Matt.
I have seen it. It's been a long time, but you know, I love it. I love all of Spike Lee's movies. And the word relevant really stuck out to me. It's sad that as we're recording this, there's some civil unrest out in the Twin Cities over yet another police brutality case against a person of color. And a lot of Spike Lee's films obviously deal with race, and sad that they're still so relevant, but they are. He's a great storyteller in that regard.
Agreed. So I was looking over Spike Lee's filmography, and I noticed that I'm a little lacking on some of his earlier work, and I've just missed some of his movies. I know one of your favorites, Matt, is Summer of Sam.
Big time. You never saw that?
Never saw it. I have not seen Do the Right Thing. I've missed a few. So I'm calling it right now, and I'm going to at least watch three Spike Lee films in the month of June that I have not seen.
Okay.
That's a quota that I'm going to try to hit.
I think that is something to admire, Ryan. I'm going to try to follow suit and watch three that I haven't seen, but I may have seen more Spike Lee movies than you.
Maybe. Hmm. Hey, this is why we're celebrating Spike Lee. It got me excited to catch up on some Spike Lee films that I haven't seen. So
I'm excited too.
Also going on this show, we have another round of Stump the Kabinski.
Since
we did not answer any correctly. And we have a batch of Hollywood headlines to get to as well. So we got a full jaw here, Matt K.
Well, it's a jam-packed jaw as always, Ryan.
Let's get on with that review of Lovebirds.
Kumail Nanjiani is back. And this time, while he's bigger in several ways, he's not sick. He stars alongside Issa Rae in the new lighthearted movie Lovebirds. Can this new Netflix crime rom-com crack the case of Bored on the Couch, or should it just turn itself in? Ryan and I followed the clues to the stream to solve this caper.
He's fucking dead.
We know he's dead, but we didn't kill him.
He liked to report a murder or whatever.
We didn't murder anybody.
1, 2, 3, go.
No. Jabron!
Okay, the guy's name is Jabron.
Run, Leilani.
And the girl's name's actually Leilani.
Shit.
She's running too now.
Kind of slowly, because she's wearing heels that look actually amazing. I love
We have to go to the police because we have nothing to hide.
Then why did you run from the scene of the crime?
Good question, officer.
That's me covering up my body cam so I can beat your ass.
We're so fucked.
We just need to find the guy the police are looking for.
Do you suggest we actually go out there and solve a murder?
It's locked. Did you think it was one of those men-only doors? All we need is a name. And then we're in the clear.
The film opens with Jabron, played by Nanjiani, and Leilani, played by Rae, after an idyllic first date. It's clear from their interactions that they have hit it off, and there's a magical spark in this new relationship. Cut to 4 years later, and things seem a little more realistic as the couple squabbles, quips, and argues about seemingly every simple decision they face. On a ride together to morning appointments, Their differences come to a head and they both realize that the relationship may be over. In that moment of distraction, their vehicle strikes a bicyclist, which sets into motion a criminal plot involving cults, blackmail, congressmen, and frat boys. All the while, the failing couple feel framed and are forced to work together to solve the crime and clear their names. Hilarity ensues. There's really nothing terribly special about this movie. The script feels rather safe and family-friendly in a cheesy way, Ryan, and the machinations of the plot feel dumb and mostly predictable. However, there's an undeniable chemistry and charisma in the two leads. Issa Rae, arguably the lesser known of the duo, manages to perfectly balance her character as a strong woman, a little annoying, funny, sweet, and vulnerable all at the same time. I'm not saying that this is some tour de force performance, but I found her to be so charming that she more or less rescues this movie. But the rescue is not single-handed. Kumail Nanjiani was a frequent podcast guest and bit player on TV comedies and movies until he co-penned indie darling The Big Sick a couple of years ago, which earned him an Oscar nomination for Best Original Screenplay. Since then, he's landed an upcoming role in the MCU and has transformed from skinny indie comedian to chiseled Adonis. I must admit, Rye, I was curious to see this new look on screen. It did add some interesting continuity issues, but they were easily ignored in a film that doesn't take itself too seriously. Nanjiani's Gibran was no stretch for him acting-wise, but again, like his co-star, this is him doing what he does best, and that smile and warmth that brought The Big Sick to life is on full display in Lovebirds. Pretty much everything else about this movie sucks. The scripted beats are dumb, and the plot could even be considered 100% secondary to the relationship of the two leads. This could easily have been a two-person play with all the ancillary actions merely in the audience's imagination, and it would have been just as good. Ryan, what do you think? Is this the Kumail and Issa show, or did I miss some craftsmanship that actually built a movie around them?
Well, I think you missed something, because I am actually shocked that you liked the two Lovebirds in Lovebirds. I would actually say the film works, even though I did not believe and or care about the romance plot between Kumail and Issa at all. This is labeled a romantic comedy, but I did not get any romance out of it. I was a fan of how the film opened, like you mentioned, and once they jumped to 4 years later and the couple was arguing, the conversation they are arguing about is hilarious. One of the things brought up is, do people who go to orgies share a Google Calendar? That question had me laughing out loud, and it kept me up at night. We get a funny spoof on Eyes Wide Shut later on. I would have loved a Tom Cruise cameo there. Overall, I like the situations that they got themselves in, but for me, it was the witty dialogue that supplied most of the laughs between the two, and I'm speaking of Kumail and Issa. But the romance, I thought, was lacking. I don't see that big, lovable smile from him. I didn't have that same vibe.
This is a couple that have been together for a while, so the romance isn't like your typical rom-com where people are falling in love and it's passion. It's more about like a slow, steady burn of a relationship. They find a way to come together as a couple, to work together to solve this crime. And I don't know, I did find that romantic. Somebody who's been in a relationship, you know, for a long time, sometimes just doing something simple like working together on a project can be huge. So I disagree with you. I found their relationship to be very satisfying, but you're right. The dialogue and the way that they were able to play against each other comedically is definitely the strength of this movie, what little there is.
There's a couple highlights here that I wanted to mention. One of them was this idea that the couple would give these random people nicknames that they would come across because they get in these odd situations. For instance, the car accident where they hit a bicyclist, they refer to that guy then as Bicycle. And the guy who jumps in their car at one time has this weird mustache. They just call him Mustache. This is something right out of my life. I do this kind of stuff all the time. And actually, it's quite funny. Like when somebody comes in and then that person leaves and you're talking to a friend and or a group of people and you say, well, then Unibrow came and everybody knows who you were talking about, this person that just left that had funny eyebrows. that kind of stuff works. You don't normally see that in movies and couples having that moment, and it's not really well explained. I just love that they gave nicknames to people in this odd adventure.
It's very Seinfeldian. I liked it too, but also you could construe that as lazy writing because they didn't bother to really give their characters anything more than one dimension. Take that as you will, I guess.
But again, this is supposed to be a romantic comedy. I mean, we're not supposed to get to know the bicyclist and everything that was going on with that guy. I was okay with it. There's a great boxing story where they got to go to a dinner. They were supposed to go to this dinner. Now they're sort of forced to go there to unlock a phone. They go there and everybody at this dinner party wants to know why they're late. And they just sort of riff into this boxing story. And I love when stories go absolutely off the rails like it does here. It seemed like this could have been just made up on the spot and I would have been okay with it because it was just so hilariously dumb in a way.
Yeah, that's the thing. I wonder how much of this movie was improvised, and I would venture to guess at least several scenes between the two were, if not completely improvised, then there was a large degree of freedom.
I felt a little Wayne's World, actually, in one particular scene where they start to sing the song Firework by... Who sings that?
It's Katy Perry.
Katy Perry, yes. Yeah. Katy Perry's Firework. They don't go full out like they did Bohemian Rhapsody and Wayne's World, but it had a quick moment in there where they're singing the song. Love that moment as well.
Yeah, I liked it. It was okay. The whole product placement with Lyft, like all the Lyft rides that they took, I thought that was a bit heavy-handed, but whatever. I guess that's modern society. We do take Lyfts and Ubers everywhere.
And then one other scene to show that it's enjoyable, even though the scene is sort of bizarre. And I didn't think it was going to work, but by the end of the scene, I did find it quite humorous. And this is when they're tied up and they're brought to a barn. And he's given the choice of having bacon grease poured all over him or seeing what is behind the door. And it's just such a bizarre premise. But I laughed. It got me. The bacon grease versus what ended up being a horse was pretty damn funny.
Which would you choose? A horse or bacon grease?
Yeah, I mean, I think the horse would have done a lot more damage. I don't care if this guy's buffed up or not. I think it would have almost crippled the guy. So I think they weren't totally fair there. I would have took the bacon grease.
Oof, tough choice. How about a movie poster quote, Ryan?
I went with, not much romance, but does have some laughs. Plus, it does not overserve like the milkshake.
Hmm. Interesting. That was another really good scene.
Mm-hmm. I liked it a lot.
Mine is this: fall in love with lovebirds, then immediately regret it.
How many jaws?
I'm busting out another quarter jaw here to give it 1.75 jaws. 1.75 jaws. It's just short of middle of the road for me.
It is middle of the road for me. I'm at two jaws. I'm not busting out a quarter jaw. I'll give it two jaws. This is one that I would slightly recommend, but if you missed it, I'm not going to tell jawheads they're missing out on some great comedy by any means.
No, it is not as good as The Big Sick. It's very safe, middle of the road territory, but it was fun. It was okay. Like, I enjoyed it well enough.
And it was short. It's only... runtime, I want to say, is 87 minutes, and that's with credits. So you can crush this thing pretty easily.
Yeah, that was nice. It does not overstay its welcome.
I agree. So you're telling me Kumail is going to be part of the MCU? I didn't know this.
That is true, yes. Did you see the famous Instagram post of him doing the thirsty shirtless thing?
I had sort of forgot about it. When you mentioned it in your review, I did recall seeing it, yeah.
Yeah,
I didn't know that's what that was for.
That is what that is for. He got the Avengers training, and he is now super jacked and in like absolute ripped shape, which is weird on this guy. Because like I said, he was kind of a pencil neck comedian, right? That's how I always picture him. And now he's like got this jawline and pecs and like big shoulders. It's kind of odd, but I don't know. It also suits him in a way. So he's going to be in the Eternals. If I am not mistaken, can we throw that in the jaw box?
It's in.
Okay.
All right. So there was some blackmail themes going on in Lovebirds. Yeah. That is what we latched on to for our top five. Tough list to come up with. What do you got sitting at five?
All right, Ryan. Yeah, this, like you said earlier, this was a surprisingly difficult list to compile, but I did my best. So at number five, I have a movie that I think got way too little credit from last year, a movie I really enjoyed quite a bit, a tour de force performance from both leads, Jennifer Lopez and Constance Wu. And of course, I'm speaking of Hustlers.
Oh, what a terrible way to start this list.
You are dead wrong about Hustlers, man. I loved it. Loved this movie for just a multitude of reasons. The blackmailing question, it's not strictly a blackmail plot, but the movie does revolve around a group of strippers who, after the economic collapse in 2008, turned to doing more private shows, and they sort of coerce men into accompanying them, and then they bilk them out of money. But there were a couple of occasions when men would get wise to their plot and try to fight back, and they would say, well, we have all these records of what you did, and it wouldn't look good on you if we released this stuff. So there's a blackmail element to their crime as well. And I just thought that it was a fantastic kind of a girl power movie. I know a lot of people had trouble with it, but I'm not sure why. I loved it. Why didn't you like this one?
I'm just not a fan. I don't like Jennifer Lopez that much. I didn't like the story. I know it's based on a true story, but I don't know. I mean, it was just the idea of like drugging people and stealing their money to me is seeing it in the theater and the way people were laughing and going crazy. It just rubbed me the wrong way. I don't know.
I mean, I understand what you're saying. I think it was done in a way that does not glorify what they were doing.
Oh, yeah, that's all it does is glorify it.
All right.
The whole movie's like a glam. You know, what? The whole movie's like a whole glamorous lifestyle. And look at us, how smart we are. We're going to, you know, two-time the two-timers and blah, blah, blah. Forget
but that's
it.
The thing. They're two-timing the two-timers. Plus, they do go down in the end. So, you know, spoiler alert, it's a true story. I'm not really giving anything away. But all right. You didn't like it. I loved it.
For my number five, I go with a black and white film, but it's not all that old. This one came out in 2001, directed by the Coen brothers. And I actually think it's a Coen brothers film that is not talked about enough on the show and one that probably enough people haven't seen. So hopefully they will after this description of how great it is. I'm going with The Man Who Wasn't There.
Oh, yeah. I am the man who wasn't there to watch this movie. So tell me about it.
Okay. It's directed by the Coen brothers. It stars Billy Bob Thornton, Frances McDormand,
sold.
Scarlett Johansson. It's in black and white, has this noir feel. In a nutshell, Billy Bob Thornton plays this character, Ed, who is a barber. He decides, he gets like a hot tip that this is obviously taking place, you know, a little bit back in the day. He gets the hot tip that there's a new industry about to come up that's called dry cleaning, and people are looking to invest in this operation of dry cleaning, and he needs $10,000. Well, at that time he also believes his wife, who's played by Frances McDormand, is cheating on him with her boss, and so he decides to blackmail her boss, saying that he knows that he's married, that he's cheating on his wife. And of course, it all comes to a head. And this is a Coen brothers film, so it's only going to get a little bit crazy from that point on. Of course, the boss comes to confront Billy Bob Thornton. It's supposed to just be, you know, this blackmail scheme. And next thing you know, there's murder. Things go terribly wrong. And now this small crime to get $10,000 to invest into a dry cleaning company has turned into a much bigger issue and crime than ever imagined. It's funny. It's odd. It's the Coen brothers. If you haven't seen The Man Who Wasn't There, do yourself a favor and check it out.
The Coen brothers are great. I mean, obviously, I don't even need to state that. And they dip into that blackmail well more than once.
They sure do.
Which we may even talk about later on. All right, that swings it back to me. And at number four, I'm going with classic. We have talked about it on the show, but it's been a long time. And it's amazing how old 1985 is. A long, long time ago. But one of the stars, and I guess you have trouble with me using the word cameo too often, but I'm going to say this was a cameo for Lee Ving. Do you know who he is, Rye? Lee Ving?
Not positive.
Okay. He's the lead singer of the band Fear, which is a punk rock band that used to guest host on or be the musical guest on SNL for Halloween. They basically introduced punk rock to the NBC audience right after prime time. But anyway, he plays Mr. Body in Clue. And he has a little something something on all of these guests. And he would have to in order for them to each have a motive in his murder. Because shortly after he reveals that he has blackmailed every single one of them, Mr. Body turns up dead. And then it is up to this wacky cast of characters that includes Tim Curry, Madeline Kahn, Christopher Lloyd, several others to solve the crime. And of course, it's based on the classic board game. But I think the movie more than does justice to the board game.
Sure does. I remember we did a report here on CinemaJaw that they were going to remake Clue. So far, that project has stalled, and I hope it never happens because I love the original Clue.
We kind of got close with Knives Out.
For my number four, it's a film that did come up on the Jaw already, so I'm not going to spend a ton of time with it. But it's another shout out for the teen romance Love, Simon, in which Simon is a closeted gay high school student that starts a secret email affair, if you will, with another student whose identity is unknown. He doesn't know who he's emailing, just that other student is also gay, and he starts to get to know him through the emails. A friend of Simon's, or a guy he's tutoring, ends up getting to find out about these emails, and he gets a hold of the emails that Simon has written, and he ends up blackmailing Simon. But his motive for the blackmail is just so that he can get closer to one of Simon's female friends that he likes. And Simon goes along just so he won't release the emails, because Simon at that moment wants to stay in the closet. Of course, it is about coming out, the movie, so it works out in the end for Simon, but there is a big blackmail theme there in the middle.
That is one I need to catch up with. Love, Simon. Really want to see that.
It is. It's a good one.
Just a couple years old, right? 2 years ago?
Yeah, two years old. I'll throw it to see if it's streaming. I don't know if it is. I'll throw it in the Jaw box.
All right, we'll find out. All right, back over to me. And at number three, I have more of a blackmail scene, but I think that the way this blackmail was put together was quite clever. This comes from the 2010 film, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And I'm talking about the original Noomi Rapace version. So her character, Lisbeth Salander, is a hacker, but she's also, I guess she's got some sort of custody going on where she has a guardian that's been assigned by the courts. And this man is to say he's abusive is a horrible understatement. So he commits a very horrible crime against Noomi Rapace. He rapes her, and she is able to film it. And it's a brutal, brutal scene, tough to watch. But when she comes back to confront him, there's a catharsis in the violence that she perpetrates against him. And then she tells him of her plot and how if anything happens to her, this tape will go out onto the internet. And she explains how everything works. And he has to pay into an account every month. And if he's late, the tapes are going to go out. And the movie's not about blackmail, but her being able to do this, the justice and the gratification we feel as the audience for her getting her revenge in this way was very satisfying and just sort of set the stage for what I think is one of cinema's great characters right now.
Agree. You'll be happy to hear, I think it's Amazon Prime is going to turn the character into a television series now too.
I'm down. I love her. I love that character.
My number three is a film that came out just a couple years ago that I caught up streaming on Amazon Prime, speaking of which. I really like this one. Hope people are checking it out. And it's shocking because I'm not the biggest fan of Blake Lively, but it stars Blake Lively. Also, Anna Kendrick is in it as well. I'm speaking of the movie A Simple Favor. It's a dark comedy that has all kinds of like heightened twists, which are just fun. I mean, a lot of it's played for laughs and you're supposed to just go along for a silly ride. But the blackmail element comes up near the end as a motive that Blake Lively's character uses against her sister. That gets really twisted at the end too. It's one of these, it's directed by Paul Feig, and it's a comedy for the first third of the film. Then it gets a little twisty and a thriller, and the last 20 minutes of the movie is quite dark. I like A Simple Favor. Got some blackmail involved there. Check it out.
Dude, I got to see that one too, man. Well, I can guarantee that you've seen my number two movie. Also, a movie that's not completely about blackmail. There is a blackmail in it, and it's brilliant, but that's not the entire plot. 1999's Fight Club. Jack's smirking revenge when he goes to his boss, tells him about how he's going to quit, but he's going to continue to get paid, and proceeds to beat the shit out of himself, right? And throw himself through the table. It's a brilliant physical performance from Edward Norton. And I think we all sort of caught a glimpse of what Norton was capable of in Primal Fear, but Fight Club maybe cemented him, I guess.
I'll give you that.
Yeah. And this scene, there's a lot of great scenes in this movie, but this is the one that I think is one of the most memorable, if not the most memorable scene in the whole movie. And it's Norton's alone. There's no Brad Pitt in this scene. It's just him sort of going through this plot about how he's going to say that he got his ass kicked by the boss. Lovely.
It's a great one.
I rewatched it. I rewatched it on YouTube before this, and it still holds up.
Nice. This could be a CinemaJaw first for me. I realize here that my number two and my number one pick are both done by the same director.
Okay.
How cool is that? He must really like blackmail. Yorgos Lanthimos. And my number two pick is the 2018 film, The Favorite.
Mm.
This had, you know, three leading ladies, and it's about Queen Anne, based in truth, took a lot of liberties, but based in truth, Queen Anne and Lady Sarah, who is played by Rachel Weisz, have an intimate relationship, and that changes when Emma Stone's Abigail shows up. So it's near the end of the film because Sarah ends up sort of out of favor with Queen Anne, and to get back into favor, she actually goes up to Queen Anne and sort of blackmails her and tells her that these letters that they have written to each other, sort of confessing their love, she's going to disclose those, and eventually chooses not to. But that does come up as a way of trying to get back into the good graces of Queen Anne, who is, you know, a little bit of a floozy.
Did she not win the Oscar for the portrayal of Queen Anne?
Right. It's Olivia Colman. And yes, she's fantastic in there. And she's just, you know, a little bit out of it. It's a wonderful movie.
Yeah.
For some reason, if you haven't seen The Favorite, it's a must.
The bunnies. Love
good
that
stuff.
Movie. Yeah. All right. Here we are entering our number one blackmail movies, Ryan. Yours better be good or I'm going to release the audio. Mine, speaking of the Coen brothers, I think this one probably doesn't get as much love as some of the other Coen brothers movies, but I'm not sure why. I think it's brilliant. One of my favorites. You know what? It might be one of their funniest movies, Burn After Reading. Brad Pitt, and who plays a dim-witted sort of fitness instructor, teams up with one of his coworkers, played by Frances McDormand, to blackmail a CIA operative when they find his unfinished memoirs that contain all these notes and details about operations and things that should be classified. George Clooney comes in. There is a sex machine in his basement. It's just really weird and funny. And John Malkovich is at his absolute foul mouth best in this movie. I really love Burn After Reading.
I do have to revisit it. I've only seen it one time. It was when it came out. I enjoyed it. It wasn't one of my favorite Coen brothers. It's not how I remember it. But one I'm willing to revisit and see if maybe it grows on me.
It's an odd turn from Pitt because he's sort of effeminate almost in the movie. I mean, he's still, like, you know, not hard to look at, fitness instructor, but he's wearing all these really cheesy tight clothes and his mannerisms. It's great. It's the closest he's come back to the character Floyd from True Romance. it's a good turn from him. I like it.
Nice. Leaves it with my number one. And as I mentioned, also directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. 2017, this one came out, The Killing of a Sacred Deer.
I think you've missed this one. Yeah, I have missed this one. And it's a shame because really I like everything this guy's done.
Oh, and this is probably his most unsettling. Well, this and Dogtooth are neck and neck.
More so than The Lobster, huh?
Yeah, more so than The Lobster. Colin Farrell plays a surgeon who has a relationship with a teenage boy named Martin. And it's a strange relationship at first. Like all Yorgos Lanthimos films, it's that just awkward relationship that while you're watching it, you can't fathom how these two know each other. You know, it's so strange. It becomes clear that Martin has something over the surgeon. And so he's asking him, hey, will you come watch a movie with me and my mom? And then here's this teenage boy and his mom and Colin Farrell on a couch watching a movie. And it's so strange because Colin Farrell has his own family. He's married to Nicole Kidman. They have a couple of kids. And it's basically a twisted case of blackmail where they do have a past together and that he's doing something in order to keep this Martin happy. And once he breaks that, let's just say it gets really twisted and stuff starts to happen to his family in a weird way. And I don't want to give anything away more because that's some of the fun of the movie. But all of his movies have a dark twist to them and they're unsettling, but they're funny. They're strange. They're just off-putting when you're watching the movies. You almost don't know how to react in some of the scenes. The Killing of the Sacred Deer is probably has the most of those kind of moments. Can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, I have got to catch up with that, man. I'm a big fan.
There we go. The only honorable mention, do you have any, Matt?
No, this was tough for me, man. I'm surprised you have one.
Yeah, the only, I mean, I had Girl with a Dragon Tattoo and I had Clue, but you brought those two up. Notes on a Scandal, a movie I've talked about quite a bit.
Yeah.
Does have a huge blackmail element in there. And the only other one besides that somewhat is American Beauty. There is a little bit of a blackmail. He goes in and he blackmails his boss.
That's true. I blackmailed my boss today. Pass the butter.
But that's about it. That's all I got. Jawheads, this was a difficult list for us to come up with. If there's one that we've missed, a big one, shoot us an email, feedback@cinemajaw.com, or you can always shoot us a tweet @cinemajaw. What we're going to do here is take a break. When we come back, we have Hollywood headlines plus another round of Stump the Kabinski. Stick with us.
To kick off Spike Lee month here on Cinema Jaw, we bring you this interview that Spike did with the Academy of Motion Picture Sciences regarding how he feels about the medium of film.
The medium of film itself is very powerful. Once you respect it and not play with it, you could definitely influence how people think, and it can be good and bad. Movies meant a lot to me even before I wanted to become a filmmaker. My mother often would take me to the movies. I remember going to see Bye Bye Birdie, Help, and Hard Day's Night. My mother introduced me to Martin Scorsese and with seeing Mean Streets. There was a theater in New York City, now no longer there, called the Paramount. And me and my friend Larry Tucker, we waited like 2 hours to see The Exorcist. I had never been scared in my life. I remember people vomiting in the theater at the screen. It was crazy. I went to New York University Graduate Film School, and something profound happened to me. One of my favorite filmmakers, Akira Kurosawa, was in America promoting Ron, and this journalist asked him, "You're one of the most renowned filmmakers ever, a master storyteller. Do you think you've learned everything you can about filmmaking?" Kurosawa said, "There's a universe of filmmaking for me to learn, still learn." That was like the ground shook. That's really had a profound effect on not just me as a filmmaker, but as a person. My thesis film was filmed by the great Ernest Dixon. We were classmates. The film was called Joe's Best Side Barbershop. We cut heads. Won the Student Academy Award, and I thought that the next week I was going to be directing a Hollywood feature, and that did not happen. That's when I woke up and realized I had to make a film myself and go the independent route. Well, one of the great things about making a film is that you start with an idea, hopefully get the money, and a year later, long as in the theaters. The reason why I've told the story that I've told, that's what I want to tell at that particular time. It's part of being a human being. You know, it's something that makes us who we are. My favorite filmmakers are storytellers. And that's what I try to do. It allows me to express myself and share it with the world. Everybody comes into the theater and sits down in a chair in a dark room. Who they are is going to affect how they view the film, how they receive it. You want them to have some feeling about what that feeling is. You know, that depends on the person's who they are and their experience. This honorary Oscar is being given to me for my body of work, not a specific film. It's something I've always wanted to do. I decided when I became a filmmaker, I wanted to build a body of work. So I'm grateful for that. Like a parent, proud of them all. Not take any back. Whatever the hardships that one has to go through in making a film and being in this industry, I still feel I'm very blessed because I'm doing what I love. And that's making films.
And we are back on Cinema Jaw. Matt, before we get to Hollywood headlines and before we get to another round of Stump the Kabinski, we threw a couple items into the jaw box. Let's open up that jaw box.
What's your pleasure, Mr. Cotton?
The box.
We got a box!
Oh, what's in the box?
All right, first question thrown in there, Matt, was by you. You were talking about how Kumail is all beefed up for the MCU role, and you were wondering if he was in the movie, cast anyways, in the movie The Eternals. And in fact, it is the movie The Eternals. The role that I saw when researching it, I don't know how familiar you are with this comic, but the character is called Kingo.
Yeah, not at all, dude. Like I was saying, I'm a street-level Marvel guy, like Spidey, bit of the Avengers, Kingpin, Daredevil, Punisher, those types, Captain America.
So what's The Eternals?
Once you start getting into like Thor and Guardians of the Galaxy and you get out into the space, there's this whole level of Marvel called Cosmic Marvel. And as far as I know, and I am not an expert in the Cosmic Marvel stuff, the Eternals are beings from another planet. And I guess they're kind of superhero-ish. And that's really all I know. And I'm sure people are laughing at their phones right now and my ignorance, but at least I know they exist, which is probably more than you.
Oh, for sure. I had never heard of them until I just did this research on this podcast. So news to me. The other fact I threw in there was, is Love, Simon streaming for free anywhere, at least part of a subscription? And it is not currently. It was on Hulu last, but while doing the research, I did find out that they're actually doing a spin-off television series supposedly called Love, Victor, and that is going to be on Hulu. So if you do see the movie, you have a television series to look forward to very soon.
Nice. That's cool.
While we're in the jaw box, we might as well bring this up. Also, next week, we have a sci-fi film. This is one I've been looking forward to. It's already made a little buzz in the festival circuit. We are going to be reviewing on Amazon Prime. It's out now, Jawheads, by the time you hear this podcast. The film is entitled The Vast of Night.
I like that title. That's cool.
I do too.
Who's in it?
Well, we're going to have to find out next week.
Okay.
No big names from what I can see. I've only seen the trailer, but it looks awesome.
Nice. I'm ready for a good sci-fi. I love sci-fi.
That is our review next week, The Vast of Night. Check that one out. And let's close that jaw box.
Which, of course, brings us to Hollywood headlines, Ryan. Let's start this off, speaking of superheroes, with some news from the DCEU. Henry Cavill isn't hanging up his Superman cape just yet. Sources confirm to Variety magazine that the Man of Steel actor is in talks to return as Clark Kent in an upcoming DC Comics movie.
What? What? Henry Cavill is still alive?
I bet you Brandon
Ralph, my God,
is crying in his beer right now. Do you remember when we interviewed Brandon Routh? Well, I shouldn't say we interviewed him. We went to a panel and we asked him a couple questions, but
yeah, that was fun.
You could tell he's just a little bit pissed off about that Superman thing.
my take on this, I don't think Henry Cavill is the worst Superman. In fact, on Twitter, whenever his birthday was, I shot out a tweet saying, like, happy birthday, Henry Cavill. Where does he fit in on playing Superman on the big screen? You know, 1, 2, or 3. And I think he finished the poll number 2. Nobody touches Christopher Reeves. Nobody ever will, right? He's number 1. So to be number 2 to that, that's okay.
I guess so. That's fair. You know, my take on it is I'm not that surprised. Well, I knew that Henry Cavill was coming up, and thanks in no small part to our next headline, Ryan. More DCEU news, the long-rumored Snyder Cut of director Zack Snyder's Justice League is very much real, and it'll be streaming on HBO Max as an exclusive in 2021. It's not clear yet what form Snyder's version of the movie will take. Apparently, the director is still determining whether the director's cut will be released as a nearly 4-hour film or divided up into a 6-part series.
Wow. I mean, he really wants to put us through 4 hours of pain. Oh, my God, that sounds miserable.
You say pain, but here's the thing. From what I understand, and I've read a little deeper into this than you, I bet, there's an entire movie that Zack Snyder created, and it is nothing close to what Joss Whedon brought us. The studio was really concerned about the tone of the movie after kind of what happened with Batman v Superman and the direction that the Marvel films were going, which was way more lighthearted. So they just ripped this away from Snyder. Willem Dafoe is on the cutting room floor of the Snyder Cut. So I don't know, a 4-hour Justice League movie, it better be good. But there's other actors too. Like there was a guy who played Darkseid who I guess is going to be coming out as well. So we'll see.
I haven't read much on this, but I did see in a blurb in there that HBO and the studio is actually going to, I mean, he can't just put it all together without, you know, finishing some effects and whatnot. So they're actually thinking of a budget of maybe $20 to $30 million to get this Snyder cut finished. So they must believe in it enough if they're going to dump money into it just for him to put together an extended version of this movie. It's obviously a lot more than just, you know, an extended director's cut. This is a, like you're saying, a completely different take on the film.
Right. I wonder if they're even doing reshoots and stuff. Who knows?
I don't think they're doing reshoots from what I had read. I just caught a quick blurb, but it just gave me the idea that they need to finish some like special effects and stuff that like were shot, but you know, not finished and cut entirely, that kind of stuff.
They need to touch up Henry Cavill's upper lip. You know about all that, right?
I do. But in that same article, they were talking about like he might actually take some of that out because those were actually reshoots that Joss Whedon wanted in there. But in his cut, he probably wouldn't have asked for those pickups that they ended up having to reshoot. So that might all be completely not in there. Who knows?
I'm kind of interested, man. I'm sold.
One more Hollywood headline for you, Matt. It's a blockbuster of a headline too. Holy cow. Hold on to your pants, Matt K. Paramount Pictures and Sega confirmed that they have commenced development on a sequel to the live-action family comedy Sonic the Hedgehog.
Wow. Somewhere out there is an entire community of Sonic the Hedgehog super fans. And we know this as a fact, Ryan, because we had one of them as a producer. Phil was a huge Sonic the Hedgehog fan. I still haven't seen the original movie. I hear good things, surprisingly. Have you seen it yet?
I have not, but I have heard actually good things also. Like in a fun way. It's not like, oh my God, you got to check this out, but you'd probably have fun if you watched it. So
yeah. Well, they cleaned up the CG and everything looked good with Sonic. So I'll be willing to give this one a spin, if you will.
There you go. A spin with Sonic. I like it. All right, Matt. I don't know if you're ready, but I sure am. Let's cue that music. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It is time to play Stump the Kabinski.
Sounds like the death march to me.
So I decided to change it up this week, and I'll let you pick which questions you want in order. How's that sound, Matt K? I'll give you just the topic. who the question's about or the topic, and you tell me which one you want first, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
All right. We are playing Stump the Kabinski. You just got to answer one, and we turn the tables and stump Ry, the movie guy. Here are your three questions, at least what they have to do with. You tell me which one you want first. You can either have a Tom Cruise question, a Quentin Tarantino question, or a Spider-Man question.
Okay. I'm going to go what I think would be hardest to easiest. So I will begin with the Tom Cruise question.
First question to Matt Kay this week is this. Tom Cruise has been directed by Steven Spielberg two times. Name both films.
I think I got this one. Minority Report.
That is one.
And War of the Worlds.
Wow-wee! Matt gets it right.
Dude, on the first one, and that's the one I thought was going to be the hardest. All right.
I thought you would just totally forget about War of the Worlds. I really did.
I like that movie.
All right, so Matt is not stumped this week, but we continue on. Do you want the Quentin Tarantino film question? Yeah, next.
Let's do Tarantino next. Save Spidey for last.
Okay, Matt. Tim Roth appears in three Quentin Tarantino-directed films. Name all three of them.
Well, of course, he is the Bear Jew in Inglourious Basterds.
Tim Roth, not Eli Roth. I'll help you out there. I'm looking for Tim Roth.
Tim Roth. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know what other ones he's in. That might be Eli Roth's only one. Tim Roth is in Reservoir Dogs.
That is one. That is correct. You are on a roll this week, Matt.
He is also in... I don't think he's in Pulp Fiction. I'm going to say Jackie Brown. Is that right?
That is incorrect.
Ugh. What are they? I don't know.
All right. Yeah. You had Reservoir Dogs correct.
Yeah.
He is in Pulp Fiction. He opens it up robbing the diner.
Oh, yeah. Duh. Jesus.
Come on. Okay. It opens up with him. Jesus.
Honey Bunny.
Yep. The one I thought that you would miss is he is in The Hateful Eight.
Okay.
Those are the three. Last question over to you is Spider-Man. And believe it or not, it is the hardest question.
Well, yeah.
I wrote. If I was a betting man, I'd be betting against you, Matt Kay. Here we go. Spider-Man question to Matt Kay is this. There have been 7 live-action standalone Spider-Man films done by a total of 3 directors. Name 2 of them.
Name 2 of the directors?
Yes. Standalone Spider-Man movies. And you know one right off the bat, right?
Sam Raimi, yeah.
That takes care of 3 of the films right there.
And then who directed the Andrew Garfield Spidey films? That was, can I just give the last name?
Sure.
Webb.
Yeah, it is correct. Mark Webb.
Mark Webb. I mean, when you get a guy whose name is Webb directing a Spider-Man film, that tends to stick in your mind.
Any guess on these latest Marvel ones?
Well, for some reason I was thinking James Gunn, but he did the Guardians movies. I think they maybe got somebody kind of newer to do it. I don't know. I really don't. Who is it?
I was unfamiliar also. I had to look it up myself. It's John Watts.
Don't know him.
Yeah, John Watts. He did both the Spider-Man Marvel standalones.
Interesting.
Yeah. Wow. Matt gets two of the 3 questions correct. We do not stump the Kabinski.
Were you going easy on me, Ryan?
No. I always write them in a way that I think you should know, but it should be challenging. And that's tough to write. But I want you to be like, oh, I should know this. Much like the Goonies question was a great example, right?
I'm so embarrassed.
That's what I'm talking about. It's like a movie that I know you champion. You wear the t-shirt all the time. And I know you kick yourself for not knowing it, but it's a challenge for you.
Well, now I know. Now I know. I've learned something, Ryan. So thank you.
Yes. And talk about learn something. I think everybody learned something this week. And that's that I have naked pictures of Matt Kay. I will not be releasing them. I will not be releasing them. And that's because Phil takes such horrible photos.
Yeah. Thank God. on a bunch of levels, thank God.
Brings us to the end of A Great Jaw. First and foremost, we got to thank our sponsors.
Yeah, thanks to Overcast and the Chicago Podcast Co-op who help us get great sponsors like them.
Secondly, we got to thank the Jawheads. Thanks for listening, guys. If you want to support the show, the easiest way to do so is by leaving us a review wherever you're listening to this podcast.
And if you're looking for another way to support the show, we are on Patreon at patreon.com/cinemajaw. All kinds of fun perks if you are a patron.
Until next week, I'm Ryan the Movie Guy.
I'm Matt Kay.
And keep on jawing about the movies.